Welcome to Exagility. I'm your host, John Coleman. Amy Schuster, welcome to the Exagility podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, John. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm sure our listeners are wondering, where did Amy Schuster come from and how did you get to this point? Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Amy, please?
Absolutely, John. Thank you so much for having me. I am a 25-year career B2B marketer. I currently help organizations with their sales and marketing needs on a fractional basis. Where I came from, I kind of like to step back and date myself a little bit. I really started marketing in 2001. We were still faxing out press releases at that point. Marketing sales were at very, very different ends of physical and existential buildings. Today, obviously, the fax machines have gone away, and our marketing tactics are highly digital. We're analytics focused, and not only are sales and marketing in the same room, but I think we're going to talk about a bit how oftentimes they can even be under the same department. And is that the right answer right now? My passion, to your point, is really helping organizations align those sales and marketing elements to drive more leads and close more business. One of my first jobs was actually building our very first website. So I come from a time and place that started off very differently. And I think to come full circle, today we're really in a very digital, very highly analytically focused marketing sphere that so often this conversation that you started in terms of the beginning, sales and marketing are so closely aligned, right? We're now having a question about, is it a marketing organization, a sales organization, or revenue organization, right? And back when we started, back in the days of the fax, these folks were in different parts of the building, let alone, you know, actually having conversations together. So I think it's been a bit of a journey for me, but I really do love what I do now in terms of helping orgs combine their sales and marketing in order to drive leads and to close more business.
So it's B2B in particular that you would spend most of your time on, Amy. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you, Amy. So what I'm curious about is whether you're offering your brain alone or are you actually getting involved in the execution of the work that you do?
Yeah, I would answer that by saying I do both. So I wear two different hats, right? I can wear a fractional C-suite hat, where I'm able to come in and provide a lot of strategy to an organization, give them information on how their people are working, how their systems are working, how their lead generation is happening, and provide that to them in a way that they can go ahead and run with that information if they need to. Or I can step in on an actual day-to-day basis to run some of that work, right? Whether that's me hiring the right people to do that or getting my hands dirty in the tech stack within marketing, working closely with a sales organization to make sure we've got the right terminology between the teams. I really run the gamut. I think I'm lucky that I get to do that. There's a lot of points in your career where you're either just doing technical or you're just doing strategy, brain versus hands dirty. And I feel really lucky right now that I get to do both.
That's a nice mix. Thank you, Amy. So something that's been bothering me for a while, I worked with marketing and sales in a fast-moving consumer goods company. And I couldn't help noticing that even though the department was called marketing and sales, it seemed to be focused on marketing, not sales. And sometimes I see companies as well where they're focused on sales and not marketing. And sometimes they're doing neither really well, actually. And I'm curious to hear your experience. Sometimes we call it revenue rather than sales, but what's your experience? Are organizations separating marketing and revenue? Are they still merging them together? And how effective has that been in your experience?
Yeah, I will say up until probably a year or two ago, I really saw them as very separate functions in very different divisions in the C-suite. There was a chief marketing officer and either what was called a chief revenue officer or chief sales officer. As organizations start to contract, whether that be through acquisition, merger, etc., I think there is an interest at this point, especially on behalf of a lot of the CEOs, to create one function, a revenue function that includes both marketing and sales. I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other on whether or not they should be different departments or the same. I do have a very strong opinion on what each side of that house is good at, because they're good at very different things. And how they communicate with each other. So sales marketing alignment is at the core of what I do and how I work with organizations. So creating the systems and the methodologies to make sure that those two sides of the house, whether they're under one umbrella or not, get the chance to have a really solid playbook to work from is hugely important. So net-net, whether you put them together or they're in separate departments, is less important to me than if we acknowledge what they're good at and we give them a playbook to be successful.
Yeah, I think I go along with that as well, Amy. The way I put it sometimes is maybe we need to balance the short term with the long term. You could argue that the marketing has an element of short to medium to long term, and the sales is probably a little bit more short term. Also, having a long term view, of course, in terms of where the revenue might come from in the future. But also, I hear some of my colleagues talking about executives needing to be ambidextrous, which basically means they don't need to be using two hands, but essentially not just worried about what we're doing now, being the hamster on the wheel and what we're doing now, also looking ahead and what maybe we should be focusing on next, because maybe there's some new products and services we can be offering to the market as well, so we don't get disrupted.
I totally agree. I do think traditionally or historically, the lines of what a sales leader is and what a marketing leader is, again, very, very different skill sets, very different goals within the organization. That doesn't mean that individuals who choose to be a CRO of both a marketing and a sales function can't learn each other's skill sets, but most marketers at their core aren't great at going out and cold calling, and all salespeople at their core really don't get excited by creating things that are more longer term, say a drip campaign or a 12-month out advertising campaign. They're motivated by different needs. And so I struggle to think that there is a leader who would necessarily be able to capture both perfectly. Hence, back to your question of, can there be, you know, a one function leader, or will they always favor one side? I think it's tough, but it's not insurmountable. I do know some. It is hard to not favor the side of the house you came up through.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It just trying to make sure that there's balance in your team if you don't have it yourself, kind of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's say I was in a situation where my sales and marketing organizations are completely misaligned. Okay. So as you were mentioning, you know, they're doing what they like doing, but they're not even connecting and talking about how they feed each other, kind of thing. How could you fix that? Any suggestions?
Yeah, I've got five, actually. Five ways that I think it is important to build what I mentioned before is that playbook, and we can go deep on any of them. But number one is just making sure they have a shared language. Are people within the sales side and within the marketing side talking about the definitions of what is a lead the same? Because I will tell you from my experience, having worked with so many organizations so often, they're actually talking about different things. Number two is service level agreements. What are the expectations on each side, and are those documented? Because again, so often marketing is expecting sales to be responsive to a lead in X amount of time, and sales has no understanding and has never been told that that is the expectation, or believes that that expectation is wrong. So it's making sure that you have those service level agreements, again, mapped out and clear. Do you have agreed upon prospecting titles, right? Again, sales may be looking for a specific type of lead. Marketing may be under the impression that they're looking for someone very different. Again, writing it down, making sure that you have that playbook and those agreements is huge. Is there consistent reporting on a daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly basis between marketing and sales? Is that supported through the technology? Also a big piece of building that playbook. And then finally, is there consistent feedback? Are the two sides talking to each other on a regular basis? So to me, it's really those five elements that help create sales marketing alignment. And we could wax poetic for hours on all of them, but happy to jump into any of that if it's helpful to dig deeper.
Yeah, we might do that later on. For now, I just wanted to ask, let's say I've got an organization and I don't have a chief marketing officer yet, or I don't have a chief officer yet. Maybe the organization, you know, has a decent amount of sales, maybe around 5 million revenue, US dollars, say. And they've been making some inroads. They've been hiring some marketing people, gig workers or whatever. Maybe they even have some permanent staff actually looking after social media, things like that. But they feel that maybe they need to get more organized. And there's a saying that timing is everything. So Amy, when is the right time to hire a chief marketing officer or chief revenue officer?
Yeah, John, great question. I think if you as an organization are looking at an exit event, whether that be a change in ownership, IPO, in the next 24 months, you probably want to consider a different option than a full-time CMO. You could look at a fractional CMO, you could look at a director level or a VP, but in terms of the amount of tactical work that you're going to need, the cost of bringing on a CMO, and the budget that you're going to need to allocate in order to support the efforts that a CMO's long-term vision is going to bring, it's going to be tough on a 24-month runway. CMOs are really great at putting together long-term plans with long-term strategy. We talked a little bit before about the difference in sales and marketing. Marketing is the long game, sales is the short game. So you want to give that CMO the chance to do what he or she is really good at. And with that quick exit event, whatever that exit or change looks like, you probably want to look into a different resource.
And I think I noticed as well in one of your articles when you talked about the less than 24 months before an exit or an IPO, I think I noticed that you're kind of saying, well, you'd probably have less people in your team. And as you mentioned, the activities would be quite tactical in terms of trying to get more short to medium term results, almost more in line with sales, really, building up following, all that kind of thing. Whereas if it was longer than 24 months, it was like maybe a team of 10 people, 10 people plus. And maybe you'd be more of a coach than a player. That was my read of it. Did I pick it up correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a graph in that article that talks about when you should look to hire a CMO and when not, and looking at the size of the team that you're going to need to execute on a long-term strategic play that a CMO is going to be able to bring in, as opposed to that quick turn in terms of just getting tactical stuff done, getting emails out the door, getting social media stood up, making sure that you've got events running. That kind of activity can be done by either a lower level person or through a fractional situation. I think where a lot of founders struggle, and John, tell me if you hear this too, is they get themselves a number of individuals on a more junior level, and then all of a sudden they're managing 4 to 5 junior marketers, and it feels like chaos, right? And so their automatic thought is just like, let's just hire a CMO. Let's just hire a CMO so that I don't have to manage this anymore. Is that an experience you've had too?
Yeah, even worse, Amy, what I've seen, lady working in California, she went in as chief marketing officer. She was quite senior in a previous job. They kind of gave her a very good pitch in terms of what the organization was doing. But actually, as soon as she joined, any of her recommendations were not being adhered to. Basically, they weren't actually listening. I kind of begged the question, why did I want a chief marketing officer? Like they went to the big trouble of hiring her. Why did they not listen to her advice? It was kind of interesting. So have you seen that as well? And with some of your clients, you go in and you know, it's all rah-rah. Yeah, we'll do all those things. But actually, when push comes to shove, they're not really tuned in and they're much more transactional. They want to see results like yesterday.
That's every marketing department is expected to have the results yesterday. But I think I have seen that and I've experienced that personally, seen it through friends and colleagues in so many different iterations over the last decade. Luckily, as a fractional CMO, I don't see that as much anymore because I'm brought in with the expectation that I'm not staying, right? I get the opportunity to come in and do management of strategy in and tactical work for those organizations without the expectation that I am there to build that long-term trajectory, right? I'm helping them get through a specific period of time, which works really well for some organizations.
So just on that then, what is the difference between fractional and, say, normal consulting? How would you define it and why would one be better than the other?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I get that question a lot. It's usually not as nicely worded as you just said it. It's usually, what is the difference between fractional and consulting? It seems like the same thing. And how I define it is, a fractional really becomes embedded with the organization for what I would say is at least 6 months, right? Things like being a part of team calls, going in and getting an email address for that particular organization, coaching and managing and working on some of the people issues that are happening in addition to all the strategy and marketing work that you need to do. That's really what happens when you become a fractional. If you are brought in a consultant capacity on either a project or, you know, a small retainer, the expectation is really that you are doing one thing. You are executing on a project for the organization. You're not really being brought in to do any of that other type of strategic work. So that's how I think of it. I don't know that there is a true definition, or I haven't seen one, but that's how I sort of put the differences together.
Thanks, Amy. So the next thing I wanted to ask you about was about verbal identity and visual identity. So if I take my own organization, small little company, it's got a couple of products and they each have their own brand. So Complexity has its own brand, lovely colors and infinity loop and nice strong writing and all the colors that are showing in Complexity and the energy is quite positive and energetic and effervescent and so on. And then there's an executive brand called Exagility, which is more, I guess, stable, but also trying to, I guess, catalyze change and that kind of thing. So essentially the language can be different. And something that I struggled with when I worked with marketing people was that the tone of voice wouldn't be where I wanted it to be. That the marketing part, yeah, was doing their thing. They do this for lots of other organizations as well. Okay, they're focusing on me at the moment, but they're using words that just not in line with what I would want to say. And they would say, well, if you want stuff to sell, you need to use these words. What's your view on that?
I'm dying to know the words. What are the words that are making you cringe?
The word expert makes me cringe, for example, because in what I do, it's I work in agility, I work with executive leaders, and are you ever really an expert? You're always learning, you know, these are little things. So, because authenticity would be one of my values. So really saying that I'm an expert, really, you know, can I really say that? So that would be, I guess, something that I would not want to be. I would not be all salesy on my with my brands, saying we're going to solve this problem, we're going to solve that problem. We say, well, if you use our products, they will probably help you, but we're not going to be telling you that you're just going to solve all your problems, because there's lots of things you need to do as well. There's lots of hard work you need to do as well as a customer. So that might be inconvenient for a marketer, of course, me saying that, but have you ever had situations like that where actually you wanted to be a very strong message, but the stakeholders that you're dealing with, they were kind of a bit more reticent about not wanting to kind of push it out too hard because not trying to oversell, basically.
So I spent my first 8 years in legal marketing. So the answer is a resounding yes. Lawyers never, ever want to use the word expert or anything even close to that, because it might be come into question. So I cut my teeth on trying to help attorneys and law firms market themselves in ways that aligned with their values. The piece you bring up, I think it's really interesting because it's a fallout of where a process goes, right? So obviously, I would never speak to the folks that you worked with, but how I approach this is as follows. I really look at the visual and the verbal identity as two separate things that mostly can't get addressed at the same point in time in which I enter the experience. Most of the time, so when I was CMO at Miller Heiman Group, they had a rebrand that went very wrong prior to me going there. And the logo that was there was the logo that was there, and there was no changing it, right? Like, we had to work with that visual element and make sure that we had a verbal consistency and conversation that went with that. I've come into other organizations where they hate the logo, but they love their tone and message. So whether you're starting from scratch, or as in most cases with most organizations, they have one or the other, you have to use the experience with the team. And I like to use a team. I almost never want to do a verbal or a visual identity with one person, because you're just in an echo chamber. You want to do it with a team and make sure you take them through the process so that at the end, their visual and their verbal are aligned and they're able to very, very strongly articulate things like their boilerplate, their elevator pitch, and what I love, which is the barstool pitch. Have you heard of a barstool pitch?
No, I never heard that one.
So the boilerplate is the thing that's at the bottom of the press release. It's arguably the easiest thing for a marketer to write. It's probably 4 to 5 sentences, really crisply talks about who the organization is. Then there's the elevator pitch. And the elevator pitch is what you're able to articulate in hopefully about 30 seconds, a derivative of the boilerplate. The barstool pitch is, John, I'm sitting having a beer with you. Tell me what Exagility does. And you have to tell me that in one sentence. And that is the hardest one to get. And that's the one that we spend almost always the most amount of time on in trying to get that verbal and visual identity to match together so that you are speaking authentically to what it is that you believe Exagility does, not just how it can be said in a paragraph at an end of a press release.
That really resonates with me. Someone asked me yesterday about one of my products, and I found myself oversimplifying rather than having something, boom, you know, there it is, and just lands. And thankfully, there was a guy who was at one of my talks yesterday who actually witnessed me talking, and he actually explained it to the lady who was asking about it. He did a much better job than me, actually. It was kind of interesting.
Hence why you never want to do this work as an individual. Even if you have an individual brand, you want to bring in your constituency, get 4 or 5 people in the experience so that it's not just you trying to get to that answer. I think it's hugely important.
Indeed. Earlier on in this interview, Amy, you mentioned some steps in terms of sales and marketing kind of being more connected and so on. And there was one comment that you made that really struck me, which was a sync up between sales and marketing, or revenue and marketing. Mm-hmm. Can you explain maybe one or two examples where you've seen that work really well? So like, is it a meeting? Who would facilitate that? What have you seen working well with between sales and marketing people, you know, when they sync up?
Absolutely. So what I first like to start out by saying, which is that marketing and sales systems and the teams, they're not set it and forget it, right? You have to consistently and constantly keep those conversations going. So I walked one of my companies that I worked with, I walked in, and again, all of the things I listed earlier, there was no alignment between the messaging. There was no constant communication. Definitions were all over the place. So what I said to the leaders was, I want to have a sales marketing summit. I want you guys to fly in. I want to have a half day session where we sit and we go through all of these things. What are the definitions of each one of these leads in the funnel? Great, great, great. Oh, we got missing pieces here. Awesome. Let's fill those in. What are the expectations of sales? What are the expectations of marketing? Do you guys who are sitting in this room together agree? So you go through step by step in that, you know, half day session. You do the follow up in weekly messages, weekly correspondence and cadence. You have monthly check-ins and you have twice yearly meetings. If you make sure that you are in the room with those folks, and you don't have to fly in every time, right? It can be a virtual experience, but you want to make sure you're checking in at least twice a year. Have these definitions changed? Do you guys want to be going after a different ICP? Are we getting you the leads fast enough? Are you turning them back to marketing fast enough? Have expectations on anybody's side changed? No? Great. Awesome. Let's go get a beer. If yes, let's stay and work through it until we know what those answers are. So there's biannual meetings, there's monthly check-ins, and there's what I would say weekly reporting to make sure that everybody continues to be on the same page.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. I do like the idea of people getting together every so often. I know a lot of people are not really into that, but it's something that I'm a fan of, people working together. I think it's, you pick up signals, don't you, that you wouldn't pick up online.
The organization that I worked with, they were so appreciative that someone organized it, right? That someone said, guys, everybody's got different definitions going on. Like, we got to get in a room and we got to hash it out. And at the end, after this first one was longer, about 4 hours, we came out with so much more clarity and could have wiped away a year's worth of frustrations between the groups.
That's really nice. Yeah. Because often when there is a little bit of a family feud like that, it's often because of a lack of transparency or lack of understanding about what the other side does, so to speak. It's almost like they're not even looking at, they don't have, an appreciation for all the stuff that goes on in the background, kind of oversimplify, and the salespeople might oversimplify what the marketing people are doing and vice versa. And that leads to, yeah, tensions, I guess. So I really like
And on top of that, when you put everyone in the room and you get a screen up there and you say to the salesperson or the sales lead, what are you seeing when I send this across the bow to you? And they show you something and that wasn't your intention. It's so eye-opening because we live in these silos, whether we're remote work, you know, in-person, hybrid. It is incredibly difficult to know what's happening on someone else's screen. Having that interaction and that opportunity to create that transparency, as you said, hugely important.
Yeah, totally. I was at a coaching experience a few years ago, Amy, and they were teaching us how to become professional coaches, you know, and there was 30 of us in the room. And I was in a group of five people, I think, and there were all groups of five. And what was supposed to happen was we were supposed to tell each other a story, you see. We're all in front of each other, like right in front of each other. So one of the guys, he told us a story. So we were all supposed to take notes, you see, and then we would tell back the story that the guy told us. Every one of us told a different story. So we thought, what's going on here? So then we took turns. Long story short, for each person who told the story in the group, every one of us told back a different story. And the reason, apparently, is that we have mental models, we have life experiences. We'd be overwhelmed taking in too much information. So we actually block a lot of stuff. For that reason, we get different perceptions, even right in front of each other. So whatever about online, in person, it even happens. So I really see the power in what you're suggesting there.
Yeah, totally agree.
There's one area where I think sales and marketing do need to get together, and I think that's social media. I'll give you an example, right? So let's say Instagram. Let's say you have a retail product that's on Instagram. So on Instagram, you need to manage your brand. You need to have regular posting. So you engage the audience, you get more followers, not just followers, but they're engaging with you. You're interacting with them and all that kind of cool stuff. But if on Instagram and other social media formats, you can sell your products now as well. So your cart is there. So this is where I'm guessing where sales and marketing need to be much more aligned. What have you noticed, Amy? Because this has been a development, particularly over the last 24 months, I would say, where people are sharing stories, but there's usually a lot of links as well to, you know, buy this now or look for more information. What have you seen?
Yeah, I'll give you a corollary that I'm seeing on the B2B space, because for the most part, we're not selling product online in terms of enterprise level sales with large software deals. It really is sales driven. But where I've seen a lot of interesting sales marketing connections and overlap is within LinkedIn paid. So it's been really fascinating, actually, using LinkedIn stories and opportunities to create thought leadership and lead capture as a result of that through paid campaigns. So how that begins is through the marketing department. How it expands is through the sales organization. So the marketing department creates a white paper. We tease that white paper out through LinkedIn ads, through copy. All of that is disseminated around in the LinkedIn world amongst the ICPs that we're looking for. But the juice of it, the opportunity, is when sales picks it up too, and they start individually promoting that same white paper as well. So you're getting a double shot for the production value, right? You've created this white paper, you're using it for paid, you're using it for lead capture, you're also using it as a sales enablement tool to let your sales force go out and start talking about the thing that you are also promoting on the marketing site. So that's really how I see that sales marketing alignment coming together within social, at least on the B2B side.
Second time in a week that I've actually heard people talking about LinkedIn. It's really interesting. So for people in the
their paid stuff is really interesting for B2B. I've been a big fan. I've seen it. I've executed it now at two different companies and seeing a lot of really interesting return. It's not, so if we talk about leads, right, and this goes into some of the definition work, the difference between a learner and a hand raiser, these are learner leads, right? These are people that we're getting into our pipeline. We're capturing their information. We're able to talk to them long term. These aren't people that are raising their hands. And that's why it's tricky, right? Because so often in marketing, you're being asked to deliver hand raisers. This is delivery of learners, which is a very different side of marketing and can be challenging, but is, I would say, a huge part of that long-term play.
That's really, really interesting. So I have a LinkedIn newsletter, for example, and so it goes up. I have to do one today, actually. Reminder to self. And yeah, I do provide content that is unique, that you won't find it anywhere else. Okay, there might be some book reviews or video of the week, but I'll have my own content and so on as well. So yeah. You see, that is a kind of a good idea is what I'm hearing. But you probably would be get more professional about that, probably using the fancy tools that LinkedIn has, like Sales Navigator, things like that.
Yeah, that and just going that next step, depending on the budget that you have, getting some paid opportunities there as well, paid ads that link back to stories, right? So you might have a newsletter with 4 stories, right? Maybe one of those stories is truncated within the newsletter, but you've got a big version of it back on your website behind the form. If you use that piece for your newsletter, get people there that way, but also create a couple of paid ads that you can put out there that link just to that piece of content. Everything I do as a marketer, I try to be scrappy, whether that's, you know, for a $100 million organization or a $5 million organization, you want it to work in lots of different places. So that one piece of content becomes content on your blog. It becomes newsletter fodder. It becomes paid campaign fodder. You can do lots of different stuff with it.
That's really, really interesting. And the next question I was going to ask you in the social media space is, I guess in B2B in particular, because that's probably where you operate the most. But where, in your opinion, is the energy growing? Is there momentum? Like, my sense is that Twitter is kind of going off a little bit. I don't know. I hear Elon saying it's recovering again, but I don't know. Twitter feels to me like it's all or nothing. You either have a million plus engagements or you've got 100 or something. What are you seeing out there in terms of which platforms are building momentum and really useful for you as a marketer, and which ones are kind of maybe less worthy of investment at the moment?
Any B2B that I work with is going to be on LinkedIn and managing LinkedIn and cross-pollinating with the sales individuals that are on LinkedIn for that organization as well. So I would say it's 80% LinkedIn. I've seen some bit of toe touching into the TikTok space. Instagram, Facebook, I think are very consumer focused, really, really difficult to navigate those conversations from a B2B world. And I would say Twitter, I think there's a place. And depending on what you're doing from a B2B perspective, it's a nice channel. But I would say I focus 80% of my time on LinkedIn. Again, because I'm doing organizations that are doing it enterprise level sales, right? These are not put the product in the cart kind of companies.
Thank you so much, Amy, for that. I wanted to change subject now to gender equity, because I noticed you wrote an article in 2017, and I believe you wrote another article again a couple of months ago on this topic. And so I'm really curious what you're seeing in terms of gender equity, and also maybe tied into people returning to work as well. What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's not good. And it's a really difficult conversation, at least on the US side. I think in terms of return to work, we're really struggling with folks who are very embedded and ingrained with the change that has happened in the virtual. Organizations that have physical office space want to utilize that physical office space. And the overall belief that there is a need to be together. We talked about it in the sales marketing alignment conversation. There is value in being together. I think one of the most difficult things that has come out of the pandemic for women, I mean, you've seen mass exodus from corporate America from women just due to the overall load that the pandemic put on women as a whole, not just in work, but obviously in home life too. But in terms of what they lose, in terms of, I think Microsoft called it social capital. I speak of this experience myself. The reason I have the career that I have, the opportunities I've had, is because of the women that I've met along the way, and men as well, who have championed me. But they've championed me because they knew me, because we would pop out for 20 minutes and grab a cup of coffee, or we went to the happy hours together, or we had lunches, or I was able to go next door into their office to brainstorm some ideas. That type of spontaneous interaction is incredibly difficult right now. So what that means for women is less opportunities to meet more women, less opportunities to learn from more women, and less opportunities for more men to be their champions as well. So it's a very thorny discussion. I think the pandemic has overall hurt women's opportunities to grow within the C-suite. And that is frustrating, right? And there is no easy answer, because it also allowed a lot of women to be able to have more flexibility in their lives. So it's a thorny topic. I would say gender equity as a whole, trying to find ways to move forward again through a number of different initiatives that I'm involved in, but it's a thorny issue.
That's really interesting, right? So like if I wanted to have an organization where everybody was in person, because let's say I had a small organization and we're doing lots of creativity and product development and wanted people to be there, I think what I'm reading between the lines is that if that's something that I asked for, and you know, when I was recruiting people, that they're the kind of people that I want, that you're going to be in the office and all that kind of stuff, and everybody's signed up for it. But that could cause a gender equity issue, I think, is what you're kind of saying, that basically there's the flexibility of virtual working because of the reality that lots of women are still supporting lots of the responsibilities at home. You know, whether we like to admit it or not, a lot of women are doing the homework and cooking meals and doing laundry. The men should be doing it as well. Hope there's more and more men doing that. And the idea of having a more flexible working arrangement eases that burden for women. Is that what kind of where you're going, Amy?
It eases the burden. So it's interesting. There's a stat that says 52% of women in leadership are responsible for more or all of the family housework or childcare, and 13% of men in leadership. So as women rise within the leadership organization, they still have the same amount of work at home. Men rise within the leadership organization and their wives take over for, or their partners take over for that work. The confusion and or the sticky point of it is, yes, the work from home may have caused more flexibility, but it's also prohibiting more opportunity, right? You don't have those spontaneous interactions. You don't have the chance to physically be there in front of men and women, learn from men and women, mentor men and women in the same way that we have in the past. And I speak from experience of having been forced to work in an office for 20 years. There were so many reasons why I would have chosen not to go if I had the opportunity. I'm an introvert by nature, dealing with microaggressions, dealing with difficult commutes at times. Like, those are great reasons to not want to go in. But I'm so glad that I did. And I would not have the life I have right now if I hadn't been forced into an office. So it is a difficult conversation.
And a wicked problem as well. It's like, it's not sure there's a real solution out there. Maybe balance is what's needed, but people even have an objection to balance because they just want to be completely remote as well, don't they? Some people. It's a difficult
thing. I think there's a lot of pointing to hybrid work, but hybrid work in a more structured environment. I think we see a lot of folks saying hybrid, come in any day, which really doesn't allow for the collaboration. It would be hybrid work. Everyone's expectation is to be in the same 2 days or the same 3 days to create those opportunities for spontaneity, for collegiality, for collaboration. That seems to be what I would think is the best solution right now, to create both the opportunities for mentorship and the opportunities to give mentorship. The group that's coming up, right? The folks that graduated college in 2000 or university in 2000 and have never worked full time in a company. That's what sparked the article for me. I can't imagine if those first 3 years I didn't have mentors and colleagues that could help me through the experiences I was having.
Yeah, the other thing I'm noticing as well from working virtually is people are letting their calendars get filled. So people are so exhausted from having calls that they don't actually have any slot really during the day to, you know, say, how are you getting on? You know, let's just ping each other, have a little chat, because we're just so stressed. It's like, it's just like full on. And so the downsides I see of virtual working is a kind of a focus on efficiency and less focus on having time to think, time to cooperate, time to collaborate, because that's actually how we become successful. Mm-hmm. I remember I had a kind of a reflection moment when I was in the panel at a conference yesterday as one of the speakers, and I was at the top and I was admiring a guy who was maybe two seats over to the right of me, and I noticed that he was really sharp and he was on his game. He was asked a really tough question, and I kind of thought to myself, well, how sharp am I at the moment? Am I kind of running a bit too hard? You know, I don't mean physically, but I mean, am I giving myself the space actually to be, you know, to kind of have a bit of downtime as well, and really be sharp and ready for those really tough questions when they come in. It's a tricky one.
Yep.
So, Amy, you mentioned a few articles during this interview, and I'm sure people are curious where you write. I believe Fast Company is one of the places where you write articles. Where else do you write articles, Amy?
So Fast Company is one, Business Insider. I've published in a couple of others. They're all on my website. And actually that sales marketing alignment discussion is an article that's going to be published, I believe, June 23rd. So I'll be happy to share that link with you to put in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll make sure it's in the show notes. That's brilliant. Okay. And your website, Amy, what is your website?
Bandwidthstrategy.com.
Nice and simple. Very good. Yeah, it's a very nice visual effect when I went onto the website earlier today. So yeah, it's really good.
Oh, thank you.
Amy, so I'm really curious if you see much agility in marketing, revenue or sales. Be really honest with me. What are you seeing out there?
My thought is that marketing is the ultimate agility, right? We constantly have hypotheses that we build programs for and we test, and we don't, at least in digital marketing, we're not testing for super long periods of time, right? You're not talking about putting up a billboard on an expressway. You're talking about a digital marketing campaign that you're going to put in motion. You're going to test it for a couple weeks. You're going to see how it performs, and you're going to change. You're going to set on a specific set of SEO keywords. You're going to put those into practice. You're going to check them for a couple weeks, and you're going to change. So to me, marketing is the ultimate in agility, but I don't know if you'll agree with that hypothesis or not.
Yeah, I really like the approach, hypothesis, and turning those into experiments and doing some testing, because we don't know what's going to work. We have all great ideas, and I often say to marketing people, don't be worried. It's the idea that didn't work, not you that didn't work. And
yep.
We should be ready for the next. What are we going to try next to find where the value is? Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you, Amy. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast. I actually learned a lot, so thank you so much for that. And hopefully the listeners will as well. And I hope some of the listeners will reach out to you to get some of your support with Fractional or consulting.
Absolutely. Thank you, Amy. Thanks, John.